Welcome to Counterspin, your weekly look behind the headlines of the mainstream news. I'm Janine Jackson, here with Steve Rendell. This week on Counterspin, George Bush cheered the new government in Iraq as a turning point in the struggle between freedom and terror. But the White House's optimistic view of Iraq is meeting with some media resistance, even in mainstream outlets. Independent journalist Aaron Glantz will join us to talk about the coverage and the situation in Iraq. Also on the program, with some of the people making anti-immigration arguments these days, it's pretty clear their position rests on fear or plain old prejudice. But what about people who say they only oppose immigration because of the negative impact it has on struggling U.S. workers? We'll hear from Doug Henwood of the Left Business Observer on the economic side of the immigration debate. That's coming up, but first we'll take a quick look back at recent press.
The country's big daily newspapers naturally carried reports on Michael Hayden's Senate confirmation hearing to become the next head of the CIA. The preeminent concerns surrounding Hayden, of course, have to do with the highly controversial warrantless wiretapping program carried out by the National Security Agency while he was in charge. Nevertheless, as far as we could tell, the New York Times, Washington Post, and Los Angeles Times all managed to cover the hearings without asking the basic question of whether that program was legal. The New York Times headline demonstrated the favored superficial approach. Nominee says NSA stayed within law on wiretaps. What's so strange here is that all of these papers have run stories or op-eds citing legal scholars who strongly challenge the White House's justifications. It's frankly not that easy to find legal experts to argue that the wiretapping program was totally within the law. Yet on the day that the architect of the plan gets up and testifies in the Senate, somehow these papers couldn't bring themselves to call on those sources. Perhaps the best effort was a phrase in the Post indicating that some legal scholars have challenged the program's constitutionality. But when we're talking about protecting citizens' basic civil liberties, that's just not effort enough.
It's a safe bet that for most people, the new Medicare prescription drug benefit Plan D is pretty hard to understand. Scores of reports have shown how difficult it's been for seniors just to sign up for the program, and the terrible problems faced by participants and pharmacists have been well documented. It's no surprise, then, that politicians might seek to benefit from the mess. A May 23rd New York Times article tried to show how that was happening, but in the end offered another example of the lamentable media trend called false balance. Under the headline, "In Medicare Debate, Massaging the Facts," reporter Robert Pear set out to show how both parties were spinning the program to their benefit. The Bush White House has issued seriously misleading press releases about enrollment in the plan, and Pear clearly demonstrates how they're playing with the numbers. But readers are told early on that, quote, "Democrats stretch the facts too," close quote. That's not hard to believe. These are politicians, after all. But Pear offers no evidence to support the claim. Instead, we learn that Democrats are saying that private insurers have made a mess of the program, that the, quote, "administration mismanaged its rollout," unquote, that a massive gap in coverage under some plans will be a rude awakening, and that some Democrats say the law was written by special interests like the pharmaceutical industry. If any of that is factually untrue, the Times doesn't say so. If anything, these are criticisms, and fairly reasonable ones, of a much criticized government program. Party politics aside, it's a bad day for journalism when a story like that can't simply be told like it is.
The sale of Philadelphia's two hometown newspapers, The Inquirer and The Daily News, to a group of local businessmen means the formerly Knight Ridder-owned dailies will no longer be subject to Wall Street pressure. But that may be the only good news in the deal for Philadelphians. As former Inquirer editor Robert Rosenthal told editor and publisher, the new owners include, quote, "some of the most influential business people in Philadelphia and people who actively support politicians locally and nationally. I don't think there is a situation like this in the country where the ownership group is so much a part of the political and economic power structure of a city," close quote. Upon announcement of the sale, the new owners pledged not to interfere with the editorial independence of the newspapers, but concerns persist. For instance, lead investor Bruce Toll is a major local car dealer and real estate developer, two industries famous for pressuring local newspapers with their advertising dollars. Toll, who will serve as chairman of the new ownership group, Philadelphia Media Holdings, has been frequently mentioned in the two papers in recent years. Another lead investor, Brian Tierney, is the former national head of the Catholics for Bush campaign and has donated more than $200,000 to Republican causes in recent years. Perhaps more disturbingly, as a representative of the Philadelphia Archdiocese, Tierney once battled with Inquirer reporter Ralph Cipriano over a story about the Archdiocese. Cipriano, who lost his job over the tussle and subsequently won a libel suit against the paper, told The Times, quote, "For an advocate kicking down editors' doors, I don't think he showed much respect for the integrity of the newsroom." Close quote. It remains to be seen if the new owner's non-interference pledge means anything, but it seems many aren't holding out much hope.
On May 21st, U.S.-led forces bombed a school and homes in an Afghan village, leaving dozens dead and dozens more wounded. An Associated Press report on the incident the next day noted that the U.S. claimed that it had confirmed 20 Taliban killed in the attack, with up to 60 more possible Taliban casualties, but that local sources claimed at least 16 civilians were also killed and many others wounded. The headlines at many news outlets that day reflected the heavy civilian casualties. The Toronto Globe and Mail even headlined their report on the incident, "Bombs Kill Afghan Villagers. Aerial attack makes Canadian mission to win local support much more difficult." But the AP ran their report under the headline, "Up to 80 Taliban dead in U.S.-led strike," ignoring the civilian casualties and the strong uncertainties expressed in their own article about the U.S. body count, and portraying the attack as a glowing military success. Given the fact that a lot of readers only skim the headlines, U.S. military officials couldn't have asked for a better spin.
And finally, given George W. Bush's falling popularity, you can't blame Fox News for looking for a new formula to replace its traditional White House cheerleading. But is the next big thing for Fox going to be white supremacy? Take a recent rant from Bill O'Reilly. On his May 17th show, O'Reilly warned of an anti-white, anti-Christian conspiracy led by the New York Times. Quote, "The newspaper and many far-left thinkers believe the white power structure that controls America is bad, so a drastic change is needed. According to the lefty zealots, the white Christians who hold power must be swept out by a new multicultural tide." Close quote. According to O'Reilly, the Times and many others on the left want, quote, "the legalization of millions of Hispanic illegal aliens," close quote, in order to accomplish this. Just for the record, the lefty zealots at the New York Times endorsed white Republican Rudolph Giuliani over black Democrat David Dinkins for mayor of New York City, and white Republican Michael Bloomberg over Latino Democrat Fernando Ferrer. That's a pretty odd way to go about bringing down the white power structure. O'Reilly isn't the only one pushing the white people under threat idea. On May 11th, Fox's John Gibson told his viewers to do your duty, make more babies. His explanation was a new report indicating that half of the children under five in the U.S. are minorities. Said Gibson, quote, "by far, the greatest number are Hispanic. You know what that means? 25 years and the majority of the population is Hispanic," close quote. Actually, Latinos are projected to be 20% of the U.S. population in 2030. But then facts don't have much to do with the sort of fears O'Reilly and Gibson are selling. Gibson has vehemently and repeatedly denied any racist implications in his remarks, at one point declaring, quote, "a browner America doesn't bother me in the slightest," close quote. On May 16th, Gibson explained it this way, quote, "my concern was simply that I didn't want America to become Europe, where the birth rate is so low, the continent is fast being populated by immigrants, mainly from Muslim countries, whose birth rate is very high," close quote. Good thing he cleared that up.
Thanks, Steve. You're listening to Counterspin. Counterspin is brought to you each week by the Media Watch Group FAIR.
In a May 22nd speech in Chicago, George W. Bush hailed the formation of a new Iraqi government, announcing, quote, "we have now reached a turning point in the struggle between freedom and terror," close quote. Bush acknowledged how unpopular the war is, but his overall tone differed little from earlier occasions when he'd cheered other turning points, including Iraqi elections and the alleged transfer of sovereignty. What seemed to change, at least a little, was media willingness to accept Bush's optimistic view of Iraq. For instance, a front-page New York Times report just 2 days after the Bush speech was headlined, "In Shadows, Armed Groups Propel Iraq Toward Chaos." That article was one of a growing number of dire mainstream reports that have begun to resemble stories reported by progressive and independent journalists since the occupation began 3 years ago. Joining us now is Aaron Glantz. He's an independent journalist who has reported extensively from occupied Iraq. He is also the author of the new book, How America Lost Iraq. Glantz joins us now by phone from California. Aaron Glantz, thanks for joining us today on Counterspin.
My pleasure.
Well, we're seeing more pessimism in American reporting about Iraq. A report in The Atlantic Monthly last December by Nir Rosen, for instance, described the situation there as so dire that the author called for a U.S. withdrawal, arguing that the feared civil war that the U.S. was there to prevent was underway and that the U.S. presence was actually creating more violence than it was preventing. What's surprising about that is that The Atlantic is not exactly an anti-war publication. Aaron Glantz, how do you see the situation in Iraq currently?
Well, the violence is escalating and the lack of basic services that's been present since the beginning of the occupation continues. I was on the phone yesterday to Basra talking to the head of the oil workers union there, and he was telling me that the amount of electricity in Basra, which used to be considered a success story, is down from about 3 hours a day. Now people in Basra have electricity for only 30 minutes to an hour a day. You also have 14,000 people incarcerated without trial at Abu Ghraib and other prisons, and many of those folks are innocent. And, of course, all of those folks are being held not by the Iraqi government, but by the U.S. military. You have a breakdown of society over time. The mainstream media talks about the formation of militias. They leave out sometimes the context of this. You have 3 years of a lack of basic services, clean water, electricity, security, 3 years of 70% unemployment, 3 years of people pulling their children in and out of school because they're afraid that they might get bombed on their way to school, and they can't call the police. They can't call the police because the police are tied into an unpopular foreign occupation. They can't call the military because the military gets its orders from the U.S. military, which is increasingly unpopular. So in this kind of atmosphere, people form neighborhood militias to protect themselves. And sometimes, and increasingly so, these militias are fighting each other. And sometimes, and increasingly so, these militias are backed by fundamentalists. And sometimes the U.S. military is working with these fundamentalists.
So all of these factors put together doesn't bode well for the U.S.'s hearts and minds campaign, if you will.
The thing that Bush has it wrong when he says we have to stay the course in order to make sure that Iraq doesn't get worse is he misses the point that we have become the center of the violence. When I was in Iraq, I met an auto mechanic in Adamiya, a Sunni section of Baghdad, and I said, okay, Mr. Auto Mechanic, you're in the insurgency. You're in the resistance. What do? He said, well, every day me and my friends get together at a cafe. We drink tea. We smoke cigarettes. And when the American patrol comes through, we hit it. And if no American patrol comes through, then we bomb the police station because they're collaborators. Now, the Iraqi political class has tried to get around this by participating in the elections that we organized. And the Sunni political parties, the Iraqi Islamic Party, for example, participated in the elections and won the seat as one of Iraq's vice presidents. Well, today, Tariq al-Hashemi, the vice president, said that he is wanting the U.S. military and the British military out in a matter of months. The prime minister of Iraq, elected prime minister Nouri al-Maliki, says that the Iraqis can take over the entire country in 18 months, and everything but Anbar and Baghdad by the end of the year. George Bush and Tony Blair are ignoring them. So then you have these people like this auto mechanic who attacks the police because he sees them as a tool of the occupation. Well, this will go on as long as the elected Iraqi government is roundly ignored by Washington.
FAIR recently published a media advisory about how New York Times columnist Tom Friedman has been making the same claim that the next 6 months in Iraq will be decisive for the past 2.5 years. Now, in the past, this sort of resetting the clock for measuring success in Iraq has served the White House well. But we seem to be seeing more pessimism about Iraq in the press these days. Do you sense any difference in the recent coverage?
Well, I was watching George Bush's speech on CNN, the one you were talking about in the beginning. And in the middle of his speech, the CNN editor must have gotten bored because they just cut away from it and they stopped broadcasting it. Because I think increasingly people in this country realize that he is disconnected from reality, including news organizations. The problem is they didn't then go to a critical voice, somebody who actually knew what was going on. They just moved on to cover a different subject. And this is a problem. And you mentioned that I wrote a book, and I've been traveling around talking to folks on my book tour. And one thing that I interact with is that a lot of people are increasingly skeptical about what the Bush administration is claiming. They know that something is very wrong, but they don't have a lot of information about why things are wrong, and they don't have a lot of information about what the U.S. role is in all of this.
Aaron Glantz, we're running out of time, but I want to ask you finally, as somebody with experience reporting from Iraq, what should reporters be watching most closely in covering Iraq?
Well, the issue that I think is the most undercovered issue right now is the prison population. There was a huge scandal 2 years ago when disgusting photos were released out of Abu Ghraib prison. And now the issue is for some reason gone away. But it hasn't gone away because there are no longer people being incarcerated without trial, without being allowed to see their lawyer in Abu Ghraib prison. There are 4,500 Iraqis arrested without trial in Abu Ghraib, and there are 15,000 Iraqis arrested without trial across the country. In fact, we are holding so many people in Abu Ghraib prison that we have had to build tents on the grounds of the prison because so many people have been arrested that they no longer fit in Saddam Hussein's old prison. And this is something that's never discussed in the media. You never hear the stories about innocent people incarcerated, which is a very common story, because the International Red Cross, which has access to the prisons, estimates 9 out of 10 people arrested by the U.S. military are arrested by mistake. And I've seen this in my own journalism, as the U.S. military will come to a neighborhood, sweep everyone on a particular street away, and take them to prison where they get no trial, so they have no hope of being released, you know, in a reasonable amount of time. And I would like to see more coverage of that, because I think it will help folks here understand why it is that there's so much resentment and violence towards U.S. troops by the Iraqi people.
We've been speaking with independent journalist Aaron Glantz. His new book is How America Lost Iraq. Aaron Glantz, thanks again for joining us today on Counterspin.
My pleasure.
The loudest anti-immigration voices in the media's current conversation, folks like Fox's Bill O'Reilly and CNN's Lou Dobbs, don't pride themselves on nuance. Dobbs has flatly declared that he's not interested in views that counter his own on the matter, and Bill O'Reilly is, well, Bill O'Reilly. But what about other, more measured people who seem to concede that immigration, whatever its cultural and other benefits, is bad for U.S. workers, and especially those at the struggling end of things? Our next guest suggests that, while making no concession to the obvious irrationality driving so much of the argument, it can still be helpful to provide a factual response. And he does just that in the latest issue of Left Business Observer. Joining us now in studio to discuss the issue is Doug Henwood, editor and publisher of Left Business Observer, and host of the radio show Behind the News, heard like Counterspin on WBAI here in New York. Welcome back to Counterspin, Doug Henwood.
Always good to be here.
Well, it's not exactly absurd to believe that immigration might affect wages. There just isn't evidence to indicate that that's what's going on. Tell us about what economic research there is.
First of all, I think a lot of the opposition to immigration is really based at the level of fantasy and psychology. but for the people, the rational part of the population who want to hear something about facts, they are these. It's not an easy topic to study. It's hard for economists to study these things. But one thing you can do is look at what are called natural experiments, what happens when a large influx of immigrants suddenly hits a certain area. Several of these sorts of studies have been done. People who repatriated from Algeria to France in the 1960s, the influx of Russians into Israel in the early 1990s, and the Mariel boat lift from Cuba into Miami in the early 1980s. And all of these studies have shown almost no impact on native employment or wages. Another thing that can be done is comparing cities or regions with high levels of immigrant workers to cities or regions with low level of immigrant workers. And when that is done, you also see almost no impact of the presence of immigrants on native wages or employment. So insofar as there's any economic evidence on this particular topic, that shows that there's quite a minimal impact.
You note in your piece that there's at least one high-profile researcher whose work seems to support the anti-immigration line. Can you tell us about the gentleman from Harvard?
Yeah, George Borjas is an interesting character. He came to the United States from Cuba in the 1960s and has devoted much of his recent research to demonstrating the allegedly malign impact of immigration on the United States. It's very interesting that an immigrant should come and want to so quickly shut the door behind him and devote his professional career to that task. But I think that's the way a lot of Americans are. You know, we're all a nation of immigrants, some who came here more willingly than others, but we all arrived here from somewhere else. And there's certainly an urge, almost as a rite of passage, as a part of becoming a citizen, to want to shut the door behind you. And Borjas argues that these sorts of studies I was citing earlier that show that there seems to be little impact on local labor markets of immigrants, he says that's the wrong level to look at. So he wants to look at the national level. But when he does that, he doesn't look at any other variables like unions or minimum wages or anything like that. He just finds an effect of immigrants. There's a lot of evidence in labor economics that there's been a tremendous increase in inequality, wage inequality over the last 25 years or so. And there are many, many reasons that have been given for this. There's trade, there's the decline of unions, there's a decline in the minimum wage, this kind of winner-take-all premium that we see. There's the star system where big CEOs and athletes make so much more money than they used to. All these things have tremendous impact on the structure of wages and incomes. But Borjas doesn't look at any of this. He just looks at immigration and somehow manages to find an immigration effect. Now, if there were a big immigration effect, you would expect that the wage gap between people with less than a high school education and the rest of the labor force would be widening because most of the immigrants who come to the United States, or at least the ones that people are concerned about, tend to have less than a high school education. And there is no such gap opening up. So even on the basis of that kind of national evidence, there's very little in the way of persuasive evidence that immigration has a big impact on native wages or employment.
This seems to me to be a big part of the discussion, that there are many other things that impact the economy and especially the lives of low-income workers more than immigration. And one wonders if these pundits, if their real concern was the lot of low-income people in this country, it seems like immigration would not be the first issue to go to.
Yeah, I think I'd love to see Bill O'Reilly do several shows on what's happened to unions, what the nature of American labor law is, what's happened to we haven't seen an increase in the minimum wage in about 9 years. That's a very important influence on the low end of the labor market. We have a very weak welfare state, which provides no floor at all under wages. You know, we could look at all these kinds of impacts. We could look at trade and its impact on wages and employment, but they don't want to talk about that very much. They just want to talk about immigration. And I think partly it's always easy to blame foreigners, especially poor brown foreigners with not much in the way of a domestic political constituency. But also I think a lot of it is driven by anxiety about contamination. There's really a very heavily psychological dimension to this fear of immigrants, and it's really ugly and just makes my skin crawl to think about it.
Well, what about the frequently mentioned or alluded to drain on services, and specifically this line, it's not them, it's their children?
That's actually kind of interesting. First of all, the statistics on just how much immigrants cost the various treasuries, federal, state, and local, is kind of hard to come by. There are estimates floating around, even the ones you see from anti-immigrant forces like the Center for Immigration Studies. They say $10 billion in uncompensated hospital costs. You know, that's really nothing in an economy of $12 trillion like ours. We have a government budget of over $1 trillion, not including the state and local governments. And, you know, so $10 billion in that context is just pocket change, as ludicrous as that might sound. But that's also a very selective rendition of the evidence. Most undocumented workers contribute to Social Security, often under phony Social Security numbers, and then don't have a prayer of ever drawing benefits. So they're a net gain for the Social Security system. I think the Social Security Administration estimates that they have an income of about $8 billion they can't really account for. So, you know, that's a windfall. Over the longer term, we do need it would be very nice to have an influx of younger workers to help pay the Social Security checks of retirees like me when that comes to pass. So welcome an influx of younger workers. But the children of immigrants, it turns out, do very well. The studies we have of children of immigrants show that they actually perform as well as or slightly better than children of native-born parents on education and income. And so the second generation is, no matter how you slice the data, a net contributor to society. And I think that the first generation, too, is a net contributor to society. But there's no doubt about the second generation.
In the brief amount of time we have left, I just want to get your response to this that I've been thinking about. It seems likely that at least some of the people making what they would say is an economically grounded argument against immigration would at the same time say that they favored free trade and free markets. I wonder, is it coherent, really, to argue that capital should be mobile but not people?
Yeah, it really doesn't. It's not consistent. It doesn't make any sense, although I think, you know, the cultural or psychological antipathy to having foreigners living among us, I think, can explain a good bit of that contradiction. But me, you know, in my utopia, there would be no national borders and people would be free to move around as they like. And so I think, you know, we should try to make our immigration policy conform to that ideal as much as possible. We are all human beings and we're all part of one humanity. And we should try to make our policy reflect that rather than building walls along the border.
We've been speaking with Doug Henwood, editor and publisher of Left Business Observer. You can find them online at leftbusinessobserver.com. Thanks very much for joining us today on Counterspin.
Thank you.
And that's it for Counterspin for this week. Counterspin is produced by the staff and interns at the Media Watch Group FAIR, based in New York. FAIR also publishes a bi-monthly magazine called Extra. For subscription information, you can call 1-800-847-3993, 1-800-847-3993. And be sure and tell them you heard about Extra here on Counterspin. If you missed part of today's show or you'd like to hear previous shows, you can find them on FAIR's website. That's www.fair.org. That's also the place to sign up for FAIR's Action Alert Network. The show is engineered by Alex Noyes at Mercer Media. With me is Steve Rendell. I'm Janine Jackson. Thanks for listening to Counterspin.